Okay,
Blog
Rachel.
Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, and this is going to be so special. Dr. Gloria Mitchell is here. She's a seminary graduate, educator, mother of two daughters, a program manager at Minnie Shell's house for homeless young women that she bought in Los Angeles. Dr. Mitchell will expand on her talk about her inspirational series, The Garbage Man Daughter, and much more. I am so excited. Welcome to MJ Network.
Thank you, friend. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, this is really amazing because I read all of your books, and I read the last one, I Trust Him. And the journey that got me really amazed is, what is your amazing journey that you decided to enter the seminary and the mini shell house that reflects a part of your life? That was the most special part. How come you decided upon both of those?
Well, actually, the opening the house was not my decision. God said one day, open a house for women. And I thought, women? I've been working with men all these years, and even young men who were members of gangs and in youth authority and the different juvenile centers. And I'm wondering, what in the world is this? But I did it. He said it to open the house for women on March 28th of 2018, and I opened the house later that same year.
That was amazing. And it's so special because these women really need a safe house. They need some place to go to avoid what they were going through. That's even more important. So I was reading the last part of the book just before and the ending. Because a lot of
yes.
people go through sexual abuse, and it's amazing, and how you did it. So you opened up the house, but DeVita is your character in all of your books, right? And you fall in love with her in different ways, and some days you want to say to her, DeVita, wake up. So DeVita is a major character in your series. Tell us a little about her journeys and how her life reflects on yours. I love her. I just read I Trust Him in 2 hours, and then I read it again because I couldn't put it down.
Oh, thank you, friend. I really appreciate that. Well, first of all, I'll just say DeVita is my character, but she also represents my life. The whole series is based on my own experiences. And so I started with, I looked at issues that we face, that she faced, and that people face in general. And so the first book is Letting Go of Shame, The Garbage Man's Daughter, Letting Go of Shame. The second one, I just took, it's still in the series, it's Letting Go of Secrets. So many families have family secrets that they need to be able to go ahead and open up and share. Then Letting Go of Stress has to do with bullying and domestic violence and all those things that causes so much dysfunction in our families when it relates to interpersonal relationships. Letting Go of Scars or the Deep, that's the fourth book. It's letting go of all those deep hurts that are emotional, like the way we feel, self-esteem, and all of the issues that we need to address about our own selves. And then that little book, the next one, My Naughty Decision, is about abortion. That's a hot issue right now. And then Bliss and Blisters in Love and Marriage has to do with relationships and marriage and how there are those high times and then the very low ones based on DeVita's experience of being a war bride. That's the Vietnam War. Desire after divorce has to do with actually trying to find somebody who's a suitable companion after divorce.
Mm.
And many who have been divorced know the challenges there. And I have a few. Oh, and then the last one in the series is I Trust Him. That's where I really share the experience of after divorce, finding someone else, thinking that's the right person, and then finding that the second marriage was worse than the first. So that's what that series is about.
It's the hardest thing. And it's the hardest thing to write about yourself and talk about situations that you've gone through, and yet so many people can learn so many lessons. Because a lot of people get divorced, right, and then all of a sudden they pick somebody else. They think they're right, and then what do you do when it's wrong again? And you may begin to make judgment about, what do I make the right choices, right? I mean, that's what's really upsetting.
Yes, and it's really painful when we think that, oh, this is the right one, this is the one, especially those who say, oh, I found this person in church, which is basically what I did. You meet somebody in church and you think everybody in church is saved, or oh, that's the right one, or God sent.
It's hard sometimes to tell the right one. I know my grandfather introduced me to somebody from a synagogue a long time ago, and he was the cantor. And I went out with him, and I said to my grandfather, how could you introduce me to him? He's anything but the right one. He was an abuser. And I said, after like 2 hours, I got rid of him. I said, you have to be so careful, because you don't know. And you can't rely on anybody else's opinion, basically, but your own. So
that's a very good
point. Savita went through many emotional changes. Why did she feel she failed in a relationship if it didn't work out? Instead of realizing she made the right decision, why do people all of a sudden come down on themselves and say, well, it must be my fault, I don't know. Maybe I don't know what I'm doing. Why blame you when it's the other person?
Yeah, but then too, a lot of times we're looking at the choices we make, and so we blame ourselves. Just like in Davita's case, she's blaming herself for marrying someone who is a child abuser or sexual abuser, or someone who pretended to be a person of the cloth but is just a facade, even though they could preach power and authority.
That is the scariest thing. But what really was really great, because I got to bring it in before I ask the next question, is each time you brought in the scriptures, right? And she's learned through God how to have faith in herself. And then I think everybody needs that, whether you're Christian or Jewish or something. Just reading some of the scriptures give you the most to carry on. So how come you included those before we go on to Mother Beth Davita and her growing up?
I included those because that's what kept Davita going, that she would find a verse or something in the Bible, a word that would really keep her focused and believe that I'm going to try again. Oh, I failed this time, but I'm going to try again. So a lot of people feel that in relationships that it's something I did. It's not that the relationship or the marriage, it should be that the relationship or the marriage failed. But the person many times will take it personally and say, I failed, and start looking at self. Whereas it didn't have to be them at all. Just sometimes peas and carrots don't go together.
Yeah, I understand that. And you know what gets me too? Sometimes you break up with someone, it doesn't work out, and instead of saying to yourself, I did the right thing, somebody else tells you it's your fault. And that makes it even worse. Because you don't need to listen to anybody else's description or opinion. You need to whatever. And I love the last line on page. Yeah, that's the second. I mean, they'll say, oh, you're so silly. You should have gone out with him, or you should have given another chance. Yeah, so he can beat my head in? Are you kidding? I mean, seriously. So I'm going to hold that page out over there. I know, because they're afraid to be alone or afraid to disappoint other people. You can't feel like that. It's not important. It's only what you think that really matters and how you want to deal with it. So Devita, I love Devita. Tell us about her family as a childhood. And she went through a lot, but she would never give up. And who provided her the love and emotional support that she deserved? Because at times I went, yay, and at times I went, you better support her.
Well, at a very young age, growing up in South Carolina, which, by the way, South Carolina won the women's championship, so I'm a Gamecock, a two-time Gamecock. So anyway, growing up in South Carolina, Devita was living with her mom and dad. They fought, I mean physically fought. And then finally, when they separated, they moved from the city to the country. And that's when Devita realized that all the struggles that people have when they're poor, and her mom was a homemaker, basically, you know, but dad was the one bringing in the salary. So whenever they divorced, they went to live with grandparents in the country. And they were poor, and I should say poor. Anyway, so the struggles that she faced helped her to realize that she wanted better. She knew that there was better out there because they once lived in the city, even if though it was in the projects. But when they moved to the country, the struggle was great, going to outdoor toilets and going to a well to draw water and going to the woods to chop down trees to go make firewood and all that stuff.
Oh, God.
So anyway, so she knew that there was better in the world. So it made her strive to seek to return to the life that she once knew. And that's where her struggles began, but it also gave her the motivation that she needed to continue. And since she was always going to Sunday school and to church, her godparents were the ones that instilled in her how important it was to trust in God. And they were just neighbors that were in the city before she moved to the country. They were the ones who instilled that in her.
Sometimes you wonder and you look up and you say to yourself, I think I did this the other day. Why me, God? How come that happened? Or why did that have to happen to me? I didn't deserve all this pain. So what do you do then? And then I look at something actually in your book and I'll say, okay, that's not going to happen. I'm going to be fine. He has a plan for me. It's going to get better. I mean, that's a hard one. How do you deal with that when you look up, even Devita, why did that have to happen to me? How come? I don't know why, and I don't deserve it. And then you walk back and you say to yourself, it's going to be okay. How do you deal with that? That's hard.
It really is hard. I was just telling someone recently how I've jumped out of two moving vehicles to avoid being sexually abused by someone. And
I know what you're saying.
I didn't plan to do it. I didn't suspect it. But nevertheless, it happened. And God preserved me. I remember rolling into a ditch both times, but I didn't really get seriously injured. So I know that there are times when we say, I'm going to go on, I can make it, I can make it. We have to encourage ourselves. I realize that if I don't have someone else around waving a banner and saying, you can do it, Gloria, you can do it, you can do it, that I, as an individual with a made-up mind who has a focus, that I will seek to accomplish what I set out to do. And since I started out mentioning the University of South Carolina, I helped to integrate the University of South Carolina years ago when most of the black folks were going to South Carolina State in Orangeburg, South Carolina. Well, I lived in Columbia, and the University of South Carolina is in Columbia. So it made sense to go to a school that was in my same city.
I agree with you. You know, it's funny because my parents wanted me to go to an expensive school on the island, and I chose to go to a city school and get a better education. It doesn't matter how expensive or where, it matters the type of what you're looking for and how you deal with it and how you express it. So tell us about your father, Davita's father, and why did he leave? Was he a part of her life, or did he just disappear?
Well, Davita's father and mother separated when she was in third grade. That's in one of the books, Letting Go of Secrets, I believe. And what happened is the father got sick with tuberculosis, and then the mother, while he was in the hospital for about a year, then the mother cheated on him. And so anyway, so the family ended up, and just when her dad was being released from the hospital, then they separated. That's when the mother took all the children and moved to the grandparents, the biggest grandparents in the country. That's what happened. And so he was in her life to the point where, and they needed food, and there were no food stamps available. It wasn't food stamps available, not for them anyway, because the grandparents owned the land and the homes that they lived in the country. And so it seems like people maybe who lived in the city and lived in the project, that they could get help, but there was no help available. So Davita went every Saturday, because her mother sent her, to collect money from her father, who was an alcoholic, to get money to buy food. And that's why even years later somebody said, hey, you know, I saw you walking the streets every Saturday morning. Nobody had to know that she was going to collect food money from her dad before he got drunk. And that's what she was doing, so that her family could have food to eat.
You got to give her credit, because it wasn't exactly the safest thing to do either. That is really amazing. And that's why you come to understand Davita. She grew as a child, then she grew older, then she met Dexter. And why? Why did she think he was the right one?
Well, when she met Dexter, she was now an adult. She had gotten a profession. She couldn't find a job in South Carolina after she had graduated with her master's from the University of South Carolina. So she moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where she was recruited to work there as an accountant. And it's the story is that the very first person that she met through a coworker was Dexter. And so Dexter showed her the city. He looked like he had everything going for her, and he treated her really nice at first. Everything looked like peaches and cream, like that would be the right one. But then she went through some changes with him. But then when she tried to date other people, it seems like nobody measured up or treated her the same way. So she ended up settling, which is something I'm hoping that people will get from my book, that they should not just settle for anybody or somebody, because the right one doesn't seem to be coming their way. But that's how she ended
up. That happens a lot. That happens a lot, because sometimes people get engaged or they get married, whatever, and then they don't want to be alone. So somebody will say, well, why don't you, I'll introduce you like with Dexter to somebody, and they automatically fall into a second trap. You're right. People shouldn't do that. You got to give yourself time to grow. You have to give yourself time to think, well, this didn't work out, but I want something better. And it happens. Girls go out with somebody, and they're in a car. I had to do that once. A guy parked in front of my building, and he started to do something, and I kicked the door open and ran really fast, and he couldn't chase me because he wasn't going to leave the car by itself. It's like you have to think fast. You have to be, unfortunately, you always have to think something bad's going to happen to make sure that nothing bad happens. That's the scary part. I learned, and I was not the thinnest. I'm 102 pounds now, but I wasn't the 102 pounds back then. But I, you know, did have a strong left bunch. What can I tell you? So, Davita grows over time, and why did she became an accountant, but why didn't she want to become, did she become a CPA? Did she go through that? And then she decided to become a minister. That's the important part.
Well, her goal was, well, first of all, when she first went away to college, she got a full scholarship, went to Pennsylvania to go to college, and there were very few females in the accounting field who took accounting, she and one other young lady. And so it was a male-dominated field. And so she decided, she and this other young lady, that we're going to show these men that we can compete. And that's how she got into accounting. And then she loved it, and so that's why she stayed in that field and later became a CPA, because that was her goal, to become one of the first CPAs around, too, you know, because there weren't many black female CPAs at that time.
She had guts, I'll tell you that much. But then she realized that maybe that really wasn't what she wanted. So how did you and how did she decide to become a minister, and what did you have to do in order to do that? That couldn't have been easy.
No, it couldn't have been easy, but I can say that Davita, as you'll see in the book, that she started teaching accounting because as she was working as an accountant, she was asked to, by her supervisor, who was also a professor at the University of Tennessee. So she says, well, I think you would make a good teacher. And so she says, okay, I'll try it. So she does. She starts teaching accounting, and she loves teaching because with accounting, it's mainly, at that time, people were working with 13-column spreadsheets. We didn't have all this technology that we have today and software packages and all. We had a calculator, an adding machine, and 13-column worksheets. And so that's just working with people primarily, I mean paper. And then the people that we worked with were the auditors that would come to the businesses or places where we worked. So when she started teaching accounting, she's talking to people. She's actually enjoying what she's doing by interacting with people. So that's how she fell in love with teaching. And while she was teaching accounting, she realized that young people that came into college a lot of times couldn't do the accounting because they were struggling with the mathematics. And so she later became a mathematics teacher. So, you know, but that's in real life. But she actually became a mathematics teacher so that she could help the students come out of high school, graduate from high school, go into college with some knowledge of mathematics so they could succeed in accounting.
That is so amazing. That is so amazing. I went to college and I was told by the dean, which is rare. They don't normally call in an undergraduate student and tell her you will major in music because I said so.
Oh, really?
And I just looked at him and said, you got to be kidding. Why would I want to do that? I wanted to major. You can't major in education at Hunter College. It has to be a minor, even though it's like 40 credits. And he said, you'll major in music because you're a concert pianist and you play the violin and go in that viewpoint. And unfortunately, I got stuck doing it because I said, what happens if I try it and I drop out? He was watching me every step of the way. And I graduated college in 2.5 years, for real.
Oh, and, wonderful.
You know, sometimes the worst thing that could happen to you is probably the best thing. The music major was fine. I could play anything, transpose it, but I can't sing, and that's all I'll say about that. Whenever I had to do voice, I brought earplugs for everybody. That's how bad it was. So I said, you know what? Sometimes you just don't know. So Davita winds up, she has a daughter, right? So tell us about Vera.
Okay.
Like Vera.
Okay, Vita, her daughter, is at the time when she goes, she relocates from South Carolina to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Her daughter is 6 years old, and so she's actually thinking that she's going to have a better life for her daughter, and she takes her with her because that's her responsibility. Even though her mom says, well, why don't you just let her stay here with me until you go get settled? And so she says, no, it's my responsibility, so I'm going to take her with me, because her mom already has a lot of children. So that's why she says that. But she, the challenges were great, and so I want to point that out. In the book, I'm pointing that out, that being a single parent is not easy, especially when you're trying to work a job and keep certain hours and maintain a profession and even having to travel. There are a lot of challenges that single parents face, so that's what I want to point out.
You're right, and I know a lot of single parents, and you've got to give them credit. And the fact that the single parent doesn't leave the child home. I get upset when I hear my friends say that they left the 16-year-old or 14-year-old home by themselves while they're at work, and they don't come home until 2 in the morning. And you begin to wonder what they're really doing. And that's when, you know, kids get in trouble. Even though they're good kids, you just don't know. So you're right. Being a single parent, being a parent in general in this day and age is hard. And how many parents encourage their children to get a good education? There are so many that out there that just say, well, you know what, you don't want to go to school, go, don't go. And they don't realize the power you get in education and the more choices you make, you can make with an education. Tell me about it.
Well, you were an educator, so I was too. So, yeah, I understand.
Being an educator was probably...
Go ahead.
Being an educator was a godsend and a blessing, and it was the best thing I ever did, ever. But I was told that by my aunt when I was younger, and my mother wanted me to be something else, and I'm glad I listened to my aunt and became a reading and writing specialist, because kids really need somebody to support them when they don't know how to read. You're right. Being an educator is a blessing for other people, and it was a blessing for me. So you know, because you are an educator.
Yes. And so, again, it was the accounting career that led me into teaching at the university level. And then I taught junior college, and I kept going down. And I thought, oh, my goodness, where's the problem? Where are these young people struggling? And then I found out by teaching middle school math that the students came in unprepared for that. So the problem was really in elementary school, where I found out there was so much focus on daily oral language or whatever the reading was involved there, that they didn't get much time for math. And that was a
I agree with you. I agree with you. But, you know, as a reading specialist, I didn't follow what anybody told me to do. I had the friend Lewis do a one-way reading program, because now they're using the science of reading, and I would not teach children to read like that. And I do, as a matter of fact, I'm going to do one on Wednesday with my reading professor. We're going to talk about iatrogenic disorders and why kids get upset when they're taught the wrong way how to read. And it's so important to not follow the curriculum and do it to the needs of the children and what they and the type of learning that they have. Not everybody can do phonics and auditory. Some need visual and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, DeVita was really an encouragement. And I read this book when I was going through something last year, and every time I said, okay. So throughout the book, I trust him. She reaffirms her trust in God. And she does that throughout the entire book. How does that help just everybody? It doesn't matter whether you're Christian, Jewish, or whatever. How did just that make people realize you could do this, don't give up?
Well, it was intended to do that simply because we face trials and challenges every day. Some people recognize them and some don't. But nevertheless, whatever it is that we're going through, we need something to to an anchor to grip. We need something to hold on to keep us going. And so some people have maybe one challenge after another. Some face multiple challenges at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And something has to, we have to hold on to some rain somewhere to make us feel that life is worth living so we don't lose it and so we don't commit suicide or homicide or anything like that. So that's why I put the scriptures there, and also they provided life for me. When DeVita went through divorce, she went from being an accountant to actually 1 year making, let's say, $46,000, I think she made, and the next year she made zero, calling herself depending on Dexter. And then when he left them, then she had to take care of her family on her own. And at the time, she was, I think, 6 months pregnant or so. And so being in a new city, no family, having no one else to rely on except her savings or whatever, it really led her to depend, to lean and depend on God. And so it's that faith that she held on to, because God kept saying, trust me. That's all he kept saying to her. And even through the tears and the suffering, there would always be something that would happen that would show her that God had her, that he had her, he would bring her through. There's one little situation in there, it's in the book, about how she was afraid of becoming homeless. And God said, go to the landlord and ask him to forgive the past due rent and consider whenever you pay the current rent to consider that to be present and start from there. And she's arguing with God, like, are you kidding me? That man's going to go off on me. That's ridiculous. But he says, do it anyway. And she did it, and God did. God showed her that he had her back. And the landlord did just what she asked him to do.
You know, sometimes you just have to take that chance and pray, and really pray hard. So she had a second daughter who you grow to love, Amy. Amy at first was hard, and she learned some hard lessons. But when did she realize that her father did something that was horrible? When did she realize that that was no good either? And how did she feel about DeVita?
Well, she felt, she didn't, Amy didn't find out until she was 18 years old. And so she had to find out the hard way that the things that were said about her dad, that they really were true. And that's a painful lesson. I think that would be a painful lesson for any child who finds out that their parent is a pedophile, or they find out that their parent is a murderer or criminal or whatever, a drunkard or whatever. So I believe that people need to know that when we find this out, we've got to face it. We've got to deal with this, and we have to accept the fact that we can't change other people. But that doesn't mean that I have to be like my parent because my parent was a drug addict. I don't have to be a drug addict. So I want people to think about themselves and what they want out of life and not feel like they need to mimic their parents' behavior.
I agree. At one point, my mom said to me, well, you became an educator. The first year I taught, I thought, forget it. After the first week, oh, my God. They gave me a class of well-disciplined problems, 36 sixth graders. They were all using conduct. It was on purpose. The assistant principal was a family friend. She hired me walking down the street. She said, I know you could do this, but I thought I was going to teach first grade. I didn't think I was going to teach sixth grade. It took, I would say, about a month, and then I realized somebody whispered in my ear, my friend who I miss, he said, you're in charge. Get tough. I go, wait a minute. You're right. I am in charge. And then I walked into the room, and I said, you see where your bottoms are sitting? you're going to be sitting there next year. Don't mess with me because I decide whether you graduate. And I said a whole bunch of other things. And then I asked the assistant principal to do something that was unheard of. I said, could you please observe me and tell me if I know what I'm doing? And for the first time, I had trust in myself because he said, you have more sense and understanding of how to switch gears than somebody teaching 30 years. He says, just get mean and tough and don't let them get over you. They turned out to be the best class in the whole school at the end of the year.
Oh.
And I actually took them on a New York subway to the Botanical Gardens without a parent, all 36 of them. And you just don't. I refused to give up. I said, I went to school, I graduated college in 2.5 years. No way am I going to give up what I learned. And then to reward me, nobody wanted to talk to me. They gave me the top class in the school the following year. And believe it or not, they were great, but they were much harder than the class that's average. So, yeah. So when I read I Trust Him and In God We Trust, it was like, okay, I just reaffirmed the fact that I could do it. So Amy learned some hard lessons because her father did something that was horrible. And overall, if Jovita were going to speak out now, what would she say? You have to believe in your own self. But before I forget, Wednesday, Dr. George Cavuto, who is my college professor from Lehman for my reading master's, and I are going to talk about iatrogenics in psychology and in reading disorders. On the 15th, the author of Fast Times in a Big City, and on the 17th, Some Kind of Truth, and on the 18th, someone we all know and love, R.G. Belsky, Dana Perry. They made me read 3 books for this interview. All 3 I read. And it's a new series with a new character, Nikki Cassidy. And at the end of the month, the 23rd, Baron Bircher and his new novel. It should be interesting, and I just got a present that I didn't expect. Jane Ann Krantz just wrote The People in Glass Houses, and she agreed to do an interview with me on May 6th. I was like, oh, my God. So if anybody has a new book coming out, talk to me because the next date I have is in August. So tell us about, if you could continue the series, what would you highlight and why? And if Jovita could speak out, what would she say to everyone?
Well, if I could continue this series, then I would really talk more.
Yeah, I wish
about
you would.
What, you know, that's interesting you would say that. I'm thinking this is the culmination of the series, but there's been a lot more since then. But most of what I'm doing now is in ministry. And so what I have done now is open this house for homeless women. And boy, do they have stories to tell. Everybody's story is unique. And I think about ministers as we minister the word, how different people will take bits and pieces and apply it to their own lives. So if I were to write about anything, I'd write about what life is like for people who are homeless and how they ended up in that predicament. And that would be Davita's story as well. Because what she did was she feared home. That was one of her greatest fears when she relocated from Nashville, Tennessee to Los Angeles, the fear of ending up homeless. And I'll just share that even myself, as I drive around for years, I didn't know what all this public storage was. Like, why are there so many public storage facilities? I didn't understand that. And then something happened to a friend, and the friend was evicted, and they had to put their belongings in public storage. And then I said, oh, that's why so many people who are homeless have storage bins, because they have nowhere to store their things, let alone a place to lay their pets. So I'm glad about that.
It bothered me. It bothered me also when I had students that came into my, you know, my reading group or came into my classes. I taught 3 grades at one time or 2 grades at one time. Yes, they used to stick it to me every year. I would teach the bottom 2 grades on top and in the middle and the bottom. So I taught 3, 4, and 5, 4, 5, and at the same grade in the same class.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to do all the same curriculum. And then I realized that these kids really needed me. And what bothered me was that some of them were living in shelters. And I just felt that with the help of the guidance counselor, who was really great back then, we helped them find a place to live. Because I didn't think they should be living in a homeless shelter. And it's better than living nowhere. So that's an important thing. Because you see people on the street, you see these people, I mean, I go on Gun Hill Road in the Bronx when I go to the hairdresser, and I see people with cups and stuff asking for money, and it's so sad. It's not that they can't do anything. Sometimes I just wonder what their mindset is. It's hard, and I don't think anybody stops to even say how come, or even care.
Yeah.
So if you continue the series, I will definitely read it, with no doubt about it. So what would you tell readers about your work and how it inspired me to move on? Because I've been through some hard times in the last 10 years, which I am going to talk about. That's why I'm so glad you shared your story with me. I'm going to write about my story with a failure to diagnose and the reason why I can only eat liquid foods, for real. And that's probably why I don't weigh too much. But sometimes you have to tell it. How come people don't? I ask so many people to share, and it's going to be on Amazon. I'm going to do it in a book, and it should be out, I hope, by June, as soon as I get 5 minutes to sit down and finish my story. And if anybody has anything else, please add it. What would you tell people to inspire them to never give up?
I would tell them to take a look at the fact that they're still here. That no matter what they've experienced, no matter what life has thrown their way, that they're still here. And then also, I've seen recently a number of people with no arms and no legs, and Nick Bajusik and others. I'm looking at this and I'm saying, it's amazing. They're going on with their lives. They're marrying, having children. And we're looking and saying, well, I can't do this because I lost an arm or a finger or so, or I just don't feel well. I'd say, look at the positive side, the bright side of what you do have. Use, as God told Moses, what's in your hand. Use what's in your hand. Don't worry about what you don't have, but look at what you do have. And then take those lemons and make lemonade. That's what I would encourage people to do.
I agree with you. You know, it's interesting that you said that. I taught sixth grade for 3 years, and then they put me on first grade. A teacher came in that was much older than me, and she had more seniority, and she came up to my room, and she said, "This is my class now." I go, "You got to be kidding me." My room was set up, you know, the books, I had them in specific order. I had a grade book, had a plan book. And my assistant principal said, "You're going to first grade today." This was the day before school started. And I was like, "You got to be kidding me." And I said, I had no idea, what do you do with little kids? And I said to her, "Okay." And she said, "You know, you could take down the bulletin boards. You could have the plan." I said, "No." For something in my heart told me that I needed to be nice. And I gave her my plan book, my first month's plan book, for real. Gave her my grade book. Kept the books on the desk, because each book had, well, 5 books, and they all had the same number. So all you had to do was put number one in your grade book and who the child was that had those books. So at the end of the year, they would whatever. It was so amazing. And she thanked me, and I taught first grade, I hoped. And I went into my girlfriend and go, "Now what do I do?" Well, she said, "What do you do?" These poor kids walked in the first day, and I looked at them, and I go, "You might think you're 6. I'm going to talk to you like you're 12. Because I don't know how to talk to little kids." These children were reading on the fourth grade level at the end of first grade. And they said, "You know, you did a great job." But I could not. The teacher that took my class died in October. Literally died. She passed away. And they said to me, "You could go back upstairs." And I really wanted to go. But I said to myself, "I'm so glad that I gave her all that stuff." Because for 2 months, she didn't have to do anything except follow my notes. I felt, you know, you just don't know. And they had a male teacher come down and teach my first grade class. And I went up to talk to my sixth graders, who I love. And then he came up in tears and he said, I can't do this. I cannot deal with them. And then my principal looked at me. He said, you can go back upstairs. I said, you know what? I'll torture them for another rest of the year. Those kids were so bright and so amazing that I said, you know what? I made the right decision. But unfortunately, Gloria, they kept me down there for another 5 years on the lower grade. And so now they came up with a couple of new programs, and then I went back upstairs, and I was so happy to climb the steps. But what's next for you if you're going to write, or what's next in your career? And this, I'm looking at the book here, and it says, when is it time for somebody to seek support? How do you tell somebody that you need to see a minister or a priest or therapy? How do they know when it's time to say, I need help? That's so important because nobody wants to face it.
They don't want to face it, but I'm having to do this all the time. When I opened the house, It was for I had in mind emancipated foster youth. We have thousands of young people who every year are aging out of foster care, and they're going out to the streets. So the house is open. That's why it was open, for them. However, it's a challenge to get them. And so who is getting them? The ones who maybe want to put them into human trafficking, they're getting them. And so I'm saying, wait a minute. We need to be able to let these young people know, not only do you not have to go out and live a life on the street, but you can be helped if you want it. And so that's the hardest thing for me, to encourage them to get the mental health they need, because most of them come from a background of trauma, from ACEs they experience. And the number one problem that I've encountered, so maybe I'd say about 90% of the women I've encountered over these years, is childhood sexual abuse. And so that's what made me write the book. So now I'm working on a workbook for I Trust Him, so that we can address some of the different types of ways that these young people are being traumatized, especially as it relates to ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
Why don't guidance counselors and social workers, I dealt with social workers because I dealt with foster kids, and those are the ones that I used to keep my eyes on the most. And I insisted that the foster parents come to school to meet me, because if I didn't like what I see or I suspected something, I was bad. I reported them. I didn't even hesitate, because after teaching for so many years, more than I care to admit, yes, I loved every minute of it. And I guess if my mom wasn't diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I probably would have continued it as assistant principal or principal somewhere else. But the social workers that I work with were really useless. They didn't have the compassion or understanding that these kids were troubled and they needed somebody. They were crying out for help. I'll never forget, this is a true story, that one of the students in the sixth grade class that I was teaching reading at the time, and she came over to me and she said, my aunt sexually abused me last night. And I looked at her and I go, yeah, I went, okay. And I took her aside and we talked and I believed her. I don't know why I believed her, but I could see in her eyes she wasn't lying. You could tell when somebody's lying. She looked straight at me and told me this for half an hour. And I called her mother and I told her, your sister's abusing a child. I thought she was going to kill me. I said, you come in with the guidance counselor and we're going to sit and talk, and you're going to realize. She came in and apologized and said, thank God you told me you were right. And I wanted to be wrong, but I was right. Nobody listens. You have to keep your eyes open. You have to listen. You have to be careful. Social workers.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I can hear.
Teaching is a ministry. I mean, that's a service to humanity. I mean, we become surrogate parents. and so even the professional counselor who wrote the foreword for I Trust Him, grew up in foster care after her mother died when she was two. She said she went to several different foster homes, and in every one of those foster homes, she was sexually abused. Mm-hmm. And she shared that, and then when she became an adult and went to college, she also ministered to, well, she went in for her dissertation. She went into different prisons to minister to boys. And they were telling how they were sexually abused. And so,
good.
So in my book, as you were mentioning the foster kids, that's foster kids, but I'm also addressing the fact that a lot of children are sexually abused in their own home by their own parents
mm-hmm.
or relatives. And so in one case in particular, I just kind of just wrote a little comment about it. I had a student, and this is me personally, I had a student who came to me, an eighth grade student, and she was missing my first period algebra class every morning. And so finally I said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I want to know why this child is always missing my class. I thought it was something about me or my class or whatever. And when I talked to her one-on-one, she told me that her brother was sexually abusing her. I took her straight to the counselor, and the counselor somehow, they called in the authorities. This child was moved she was moved away from our school. They took her away. Well, 2 months later, just 2 months later, she came back to the school to see me, and she brought all her work, and she had A's on all of her math papers and showed them to me. And she said, I came back to show you that. She said, I learned all of this from you. I was listening. I just couldn't do the work when she did come to class. She says, I learned it from you. That blessed me. And so I also indicated that in the book.
I agree with you. Because there were, I don't know if you see them on Facebook, Michael Taylor, Angelina Morrison, Nadine Rannigan, it's a whole bunch of my students. And Michael started a group, I think everybody knows about it, Team Spartans Bates, and it's a fitness group for kids of all nationalities, all races. And he once said, he said it on when he was on my show, he said, if not for you straightening out my butt, I'd be in jail. He said, you, as little as you were, you didn't tolerate me at all. I go, that's because I still love you. He's such an inspiration to other kids. It's amazing that if you take that 2 seconds sometimes to say, you can do it, I'm not going to give up on you, I'm going to drive you crazy until you succeed, you'd be surprised. But Gloria, thank you so much. Where can everybody learn more about you and other things that you do? Because you do a lot more than that.
Well, my website is GloriaShellMitchell.com, which I should update it more often, but it has my information there. And my books are available at Amazon.com. So basically that. But, yeah, I'm on the web, and they can look me up, Gloria Shell Mitchell.
And before we go, what were you were standing on a building the other day, 20 feet high. I could not do that. I have acrophobia. I'm afraid of heights. How did you do that? That was amazing.
It's a rooftop, friend. I was on a rooftop. I met with the mayor of Los Angeles, Mayor Karen Bass, and said, look, I want to help you address this homeless problem in Los Angeles. And so I asked if we could form a task force, and she agreed. And so I had a number of other housing providers with me. So we were going around looking at possible places where we might mm-hmm. possibly be able to have developers put the same type of buildings into South Los Angeles, where the majority of the homeless are. And so that's what I was doing, traveling around with the mayor's task force.
That is fantastic. That is so important. will let me know if there's anything I could do to make it better and let people know about it. But Gloria, thank you so much. Whatever you write, let me know. And anytime you want to come back on and talk about this issue, just let me know. Everybody, it's a beautiful day.
Thank you.
Be careful. We're going to have a solar eclipse, and make sure that if you don't have the glasses, keep the Venetians down and don't look at the sun because you don't want to lose your eyesight. Everybody, Gloria, stay well. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.